Today, the part of Bill Handel will be played by not Bill Handel. I mean, it's Handel's show, so see the difference. And now, here's not Bill Handel.
KFI AM 640, live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app, and also not live on the iHeartRadio app, meaning if you miss a live show, you can get the podcast through the on-demand function right through that app. This is Bill Handel's show. He is gone. He will be back on Monday. Wayne Resnick here sitting in. Jason Middleton is here in for Jennifer Jones-Lee. Some of the stories we're watching for you at KFI. There's a new survey out from the National Retail Federation, and even with inflation going on, 8 million more people than last year plan to go looking for the best deals between now and Cyber Monday. And E. Jean Carroll, a woman who sued former President Trump for defamation, is suing again under a new New York law that allows her to bring another claim for that sexual assault that she alleges, even though it normally would have been too old for her to sue. And now it's time for the incredible story of why we eat pecan pie. I would go even farther and say it's the incredible story of why there even is pecan pie. I feel like pecan pie is not a terribly polarizing food. I'm sure there are people who don't like a pecan pie, but I think most people like a nice pecan pie. Pecan pie is decadent as hell. Oh my God. And there's a reason that it's decadent, and it's because of what's in it. And there's a whole history about what's in it. So here we go. Buckle up, everybody. Apple pie is totally American, but apples are not native, or were not native to this continent. But pecans are. There were pecans here in what we now call the United States like 2,000 years ago. Indigenous people ate them. It was an important food source. We think the word pecan comes from an Algonquin word, pacan, and that means a nut that you have to crack with a stone. So let's fast forward a little bit. Founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson is growing pecans at Monticello. He tells his buddy George Washington, oh my God, have you tried these nuts? You should grow these nuts too. George Washington goes, all right, I got wooden teeth, but I may not want to crack down on a pecan because of my dumb wooden teeth, but I'll start growing them at Mount Vernon. And that's fine. And you had kind of these smaller operations growing pecans. Now, in order for pecan pie to become a big deal, pecans have to become kind of a big deal. And we wouldn't have commercial pecan growing. We wouldn't probably have pecan pie if it wasn't for a man known only as Antoine. Antoine was an enslaved man. And in 1847, he invented a way to graft pecan trees, where you take part of a tree and you put it on the rootstock of another tree. And it's a very easy way to propagate pecan trees, or at least a relatively easy way to propagate pecan trees. And if it wasn't for that invention or discovery, you wouldn't have massive pecan farms. You wouldn't have pecans available at every store that you go to. So thanks to him, pecans started to spread all across the South. And then it wasn't too long, only about 20 years after he invented this way of propagating pecans, you had pecans available everywhere you go. You could go to a grocery store in New York City in the middle of winter and you could buy them. Now, also, pecans were kind of celebrity nuts for a while. When you would go to a world fair or a world exposition or a county fair or a big festival all over the place, they would have pecans on display, like, hey, here's the pecan booth. Look at these pecans. I don't know that we're that into them these days, but man, oh man, they were a big deal. Okay, so pecans becoming more popular. And then you did start to see early recipes for some kind of a pie with pecans in them. But it was all over the map. Like, there was a recipe in 1897 in Ladies' Home Journal. And it was a pecan pie, but you would not recognize it. because it had meringue? What the hell is that on a pecan pie? The pecan pie that we know and love came about in like the 30s or the 40s, thanks to Karo corn syrup. You know Karo corn syrup. Karo corn syrup came on the market right around the same time as Coca-Cola and Cracker Jack, Jell-O, all these food brands that became really influential on this country. And so there it is. It's a liquid sweetener. You know what it is. Have you ever taken a shot of Karo corn syrup? I don't recommend it. I don't recommend it for your pancreas. I don't recommend it really for the face you're going to make, even if you think you like sweet things. But it has its place. And it was invented by, listen to the name of this company, the Corn Products Refining Company of New York and Chicago. That's the name of the company. First hit the market in 1902 in a limited form, and then 30s, 40s, boom, it was everywhere. And it's great because, I mean, the reason that you would use it is that some kinds of sweeteners, when you heat them up, they crystallize, and you don't want that. So this doesn't do that. So it was really good for desserts and candy, and there you go. Now, Karo, with this product, they wanted to become as popular as possible. Massive marketing. Full-page ads in Ladies Home Journal. They, in 1924, launched a $250,000 publicity campaign. That's $7 million by today's money. Actually, a little over $7 million by today's money. And one of the things that they did as part of this big push is they started giving out free cookbooks, including the aptly named Karo Cookbook. And it's a bunch of recipes where you use Karo corn syrup. And boom, the pecan pie by Karo. The pecan pie that we now understand as pecan pie, the thing you think of, invented by the wife of a sales executive at the Karo company. And because of all the marketing behind it, it exploded. And as pecan pie rose in popularity, Karo corn syrup people started to feature pecan pie more and more and more in their marketing. And by the late 50s, they would run recipes for pecan pie in almost every issue of Better Homes and Gardens. And at that point, at least according to surveys from that time, almost every single person in America, if they hadn't actually eaten pecan pie, they knew what it was. They knew exactly what it was. Now, here's the thing. The Karo company maybe doesn't want you to know this. There is a record of a recipe for a pecan pie using corn syrup earlier that was published in this student publication of a college in Tennessee, Karo Pecan Pie. So maybe that wife didn't invent it really, wasn't the first one to stumble on it, but definitely it was her recipe that went crazy. And that's why you got pecan pies all over the damn place. There is a documentary on Netflix, and it's called Pepsi, Where's My Jet? It kind of sounds like a Brian Eno, David Bowie collaboration album to me, but it's not. It's about a promotion that Pepsi did during the 90s. And man, oh man, because, you know, I think the 90s was peak cola wars. You had Coke, of course, Coke is the undisputed world leader of sodas. It just is. And then you had Pepsi. Pepsi had come on the scene later, so it was younger. They definitely wanted to pitch themselves as being kind of hipper, if you will, the hip soda. And they did some really crazy advertising. And they got a lot of celebrities to pitch for them. Madonna, Michael Jackson, Britney Spears, Cindy Crawford, Marlon Brando. And they also did some campaigns and contests. And this documentary is about this particular contest, 1996, the Drink Pepsi, Get Stuff campaign. And it was pretty straightforward. When you bought Pepsi, you got Pepsi points. And you could accrue Pepsi points and get things like a t-shirt with the Pepsi logo on it. That was 80 Pepsi points. You could get a leather jacket. That's probably why I was talking about having a leather jacket store as an example earlier in the show, because I read this article. A leather jacket was 1,200 Pepsi points. You could get a cool pair of sunglasses for only 125 Pepsi points. And then at the end of the ad, the final prize is revealed, and it's a $23 million Harrier fighter jet for 7 million Pepsi points. And the guy who created this campaign at Pepsi meant it as a joke. Hey, people don't offer, you know, military planes as a prize in a contest. It was just supposed to be a joke. But there was at least one man who did not feel that it was a joke at all. And I'm not saying this man was stupid. I'm saying this man decided he was going to get that jet. His name is John Leonard. He was at the time 20 years old. He was a community college student. He also was big into mountain climbing, and he would like to travel around the world. And so he really wanted the jet to use, because he was working a bunch of odd jobs just to support the little amount of mountain climbing he could do. He was a window washer and a paper boy and a mountain climbing guide and a teriyaki delivery person. I guess that means he delivered food from a teriyaki restaurant. So he started to crunch the numbers. 7 million Pepsi points. All right, I got to buy 190 cans of Pepsi every single day for 100 years to get 7 million Pepsi points. I don't know how that happens. Certainly can't drink 190 cans of Pepsi a day. Even if I tried to get my friends and my family, hey, everybody, let's drink a bunch of Pepsi every day. You can't do it. But he had a friend. He had a mountain climbing friend who was an investor and was older, was like in his 40s. And he got together with that guy, Todd Hoffman, and they actually put together a business plan to get this jet through this Pepsi contest. And they did the calculations. They said, okay, we have to buy all the Pepsi. So I got to buy about 1.4 million 12 packs of Pepsi. That's like 16 million cans of Pepsi. Then he got to store them somewhere. So they calculated how much storage space they needed for 16 million cans of Pepsi. 600,000 cubic feet of storage. Okay. Well, I don't think we can have this at one warehouse. We're going to have different warehouses. I don't know if they're all in one city, if we do it across six big cities. We also had to cut off these labels to show your Pepsi points. So somebody's got to do that. And we're talking about 16 million cans of Pepsi. We're going to have to hire people to do that part of it. So they put it all together and they determined it would cost about $4.3 million to do this. So then the next thing they needed to do, and this was smart of them, is they said, hey, before we even do this, we better find out if it's legal for us to buy a Harrier fighter jet. So they go to the Pentagon. And I guess he pretended that he was a student doing a school project or something. And he said, hey, can a person buy a Harrier fighter jet? And he was able to get in touch with the guy who was the chief Pentagon spokesman for about 7 years. The guy was named Kenneth Bacon. And Kenneth Bacon said, you can legally get a Harrier jet as long as it doesn't have the weapons and stuff on it. And they're like, okay, we're ready to go. We're going to do it. And then he read the fine print again, and he realized they didn't have to spend $4.3 million. They didn't have to rent warehouses. They didn't even have to buy 16 million cans of Pepsi. They didn't have to buy any Pepsi, because in the fine print, it said that you could buy Pepsi points directly for 10 cents a Pepsi point. Wait, I need 7 million Pepsi points, 10 cents a Pepsi point. That's $700,000. And then there was a $10 handling and delivery charge. And so these two guys wrote a check to Pepsi for $700,000. It shows up at the headquarters of Pepsi. They probably fainted because, of course, there was no jet. It wasn't real. It was meant as a joke. They didn't have a Harrier jet prize. So they were like, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? Maybe we ignore it. We probably have to ignore it. Because what if other people start trying to do this kind of stuff? And then somebody else at Pepsi said, okay, why don't we keep the money? We'll take the money and we'll give them the model jet that we used in the commercial. How about that? But ultimately, Pepsi decided, here's what we're going to do. We're not going to cash the check. And they sent Leonard a letter and it said, thanks for the effort, ha, ha, ha. It was meant to be a joke. For your troubles, here's coupons for two cases of Pepsi. Well, they didn't like that very much, these two guys. And so they decided they were going to sue Pepsi to get this jet. But before they could get a lawyer, Pepsi sued them first. Pepsi said, don't even try. We want an order that you can't even try to get this jet. And here's why. Because we say it's illegal to buy a Harrier jet. And you can't sue for an offer that's illegal. Because if it's not legal, it's not legitimate. Well, they already knew that the Pentagon had told them that they could have the jet. So they didn't like being sued very much. And so Leonard got a friend of his who at the time was in law school at George Washington University Law School to help him out with this situation. And that man's name is Michael Avenatti. Yeah, that one. Not a different one. It's not a coincidence. It's that one. And so then law student Michael Avenatti gets involved and decides that what they're going to do is they're just going to do a big public pressure campaign against Pepsi and try to goad them into doing something. But, you know, Pepsi can launch a $50 million ad campaign, but these guys can't. So they went on talk radio shows and that kind of thing just to try to get the word out. And the word did get out and media outlets started to cover the situation. And Avenatti says that he spent hundreds of hours researching Pepsi and he found that there was a campaign in the Philippines in 1992 was called Number Fever that Pepsi did. It was kind of like a lottery. If your Pepsi bottle had the winning number under the cap, you got a certain amount of money. And Pepsi had screwed it up because they picked a winning number that ended up being on 600,000 bottle caps. And they weren't going to be able to pay off any of that prize money. And they wanted to use it to say, hey, Pepsi has a habit of like doing contests that they can't fulfill. But spoiler alert, he lost his case against Pepsi based on the judge finding that no reasonable person could believe that Pepsi was really offering a Harrier jet as a prize. What a story. And don't lie, you didn't see Michael Avenatti showing up in this story, did you?
If you're going to do it, let's go all the way. Come on.
Handle on the News. Oh, late edition. Here's not Bill Handel.
KFI AM 640 live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. And if you miss any KFI show live, you can catch up with a podcast through the iHeartRadio app. It is the Bill Handel Show. That dude already, spoiler alert, it's not Bill Handel. It's Wayne Resnick in. Bill's back on Monday. Jason Middleton is here in for Jennifer Jones-Lee, and it's not only time for Handle on the News. That's true. It's also true that Handle on the News Late Edition is sponsored by DirectBuyers.com, the hassle-free way to sell your home at a fair price in 10 days or fewer. DirectBuyers.com. That is all true. And also, this is a super segment, so there will be no break until the top of the hour. All those truth bombs having been dropped on your sweet little heads, let's begin Handle on News Late Edition. Jason Middleton and me, lead story. Yes, red flag warning in Southern California, high winds, low humidity, not as cold as you might like it to be for a Thanksgiving day as well. So we got big brush fire danger. Now, Jason, is this red flag warning going to expire at 11 a.m. or are they extending it?
I've seen nothing to suggest otherwise. We're still scheduled for an 11 o'clock suspension of this red flag warning for Ventura and Los Angeles counties. Looks like OC has already slowed down enough that they took away everything, including the watch.
All right. And this is based on the wind slowing down, I assume.
Yes. And to that point, I've been gone from LA for 12 years. I moved away, went up to the Bay Area, and then just came back. I did not know this. The winds are leading to a high brush fire because of where they blow from. So when the wind comes from the east, it's much drier than winds coming, obviously, from the ocean. It's a little bit different when you live in the Bay Area. If it's hot inland, that's when you get fog because it pulls in the cooler air from the Pacific. So.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Just a little fun fact there. I hope. Black Friday. That's today, Wayne. Shoppers apparently are looking for things today. And I actually have some, and you don't have this in front of you. Producer Alex didn't have this. I just got it from Adobe Analytics. And consumers spent a record $5.29 billion on Thanksgiving Day yesterday. That's up 2.9% from the previous Thanksgiving. And that's kind of a shocker because we all kind of thought Black Friday was going to come in, you know, fine, just, you know, fine, you know. But to come in that hot, it kind of like heads us into the retail weekend with a nice head of steam.
Yeah, but isn't part of that when retailers shift their marketing strategies to start promoting specifically shopping on Thanksgiving, and when people start to adopt shopping on Thanksgiving Day as a social event, then it may not be surprising that at some point we might see Thanksgiving Day eclipse Black Friday in terms of amount of money spent.
It's possible for sure. I will say that, and I see where you're coming from for sure, and you don't have this, like I said, in front of you, but it also shows that mobile shopping from smartphones drove 55% of those online sales. So, so that's somebody sitting at the dinner table being like, yeah, no, I was totally listening to grandma tell that story again and then buying a new couch.
So I had it wrong.
Well, maybe. That's just one data point.
Jason, I had it wrong. I thought it was, and this is partly because I know some people is now the big deal is to go on Thanksgiving to the stores that are open. But I also just realized there's a lot of stores that used to be open on Thanksgiving and that aren't anymore, like Walmart and Target.
Right.
They don't. So really, if I had thought about it a little more, I would have asked, my follow-up would have been, are these people going to stores or are these people shopping online? Because you're sitting around with your family and you don't want to listen to them blab anymore. So yeah, you pull out the smartphone and you buy some stuff.
A lot of those not being open on Thanksgiving has to do with labor retention too. They don't want to work their people on the holidays. Real quick. So far, first 24 days of this month, Americans have spent $77.74 billion. Black Friday is expected to bring in $9 billion today. And that's just,
wait, what was the number yesterday?
Yesterday was $5.29 billion.
Oh, I see. I was wrong about that, too. Black Friday will eclipse Thanksgiving and not the other way around.
Well, yeah, but again, I don't think that has to do so much with marketing. It's just like that's our regular flow. And they're also showing here that notable discounts helped a lot. Apparel, 14% discounts, appliances, TVs. But if you're looking for a computer, this is an educated, data-based prediction, just a guess. Wait until Cyber Monday because those discounts are expected to peak at 27% off.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So,
all right. Also peaking, CHP and other law enforcement agencies' enforcement of traffic and drunk driving laws. We talked about this earlier in the week when the CHP announced it would enter their maximum enforcement period. It started 6 p.m. on Wednesday. It's going to go through midnight on Sunday. And, you know, LAPD, I'm sure, will do saturation patrols and other police departments because, like with almost anything that we call a holiday, some people like to have too much to drink.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned that a little bit earlier, too. It looks here, last Thanksgiving, 42 people were killed in crashes over Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah.
That includes 16 pedestrians. Yikes. That's higher than I would have anticipated.
Yeah. You know, quite honestly, there should be, if you want to call it maximum enforcement periods or what have you, year round, all the time, these agencies should be putting more of their resources into this and less into hiding by the side of the road with their radar guns. Because going 40 in a 35 zone is not dangerous.
Especially if you're going downhill, by the way. I forget my range.
Well, I'm just saying that let's take some of these cops that you have out there trying to just catch people simple speeding and have them looking for drunk drivers.
Fair enough. That's the bigger threat. The owner of the Colorado LGBTQ club where the shooting happened, called Club Q, says that some of these, this type of hate, and that's a quote from him, this new type of hate is also kind of like prejudice from above, if you will, from politicians using certain language to compartmentalize, I guess a decent word for that too, by right-wing activists and politicians who complain about sexualization or grooming of children, things like that.
Because I think what's happening is this. These politicians who are trying to please their base, they're starting to talk about simply gay, being gay or trans or what have you, or gender fluid or anything. They're starting to talk about it in the same way they talk about things like child molestation and rape. Now, for a long time, the hate, if you want to call it hate against LGBTQ people, was expressed more as moral outrage. And it would live more in the area of, let's say, that and adultery and drinking too much and gambling. And that's not right and that's not fair, but it was qualitatively different. It was more like an aberrational moral failing. Now, number one, it's politicians who are talking about it. Mm-hmm. And number two, they're talking about it the same way that they talk about serious crimes. And you can see how that could lead to an escalation of acting out against these communities.
Right.
Because they're saying it's going from being just kind of hateful to being incitement.
Yeah, I get. And you used the word qualitatively there, too. I get that. It just seems like the more... Yeah, maybe it's permission. You're right. I mean, anecdotally speaking, you're right. It is more of an incitement than just a statement of moral outrage. It's more kind of like moral outrage, do something about it, moral outrage, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Ukrainian army managed to liberate the city of Kherson. Russia took it over. Ukraine took it back, kicked them out of there. And... because Vladimir Putin is, at the end of the day, for all this talk of him as like this super inscrutable, clever, cold-minded, like genius of oppression, I think he's a little baby. Mm-hmm. I think he's a scared little baby, and he's having a temper tantrum, and they're just raining missiles down on this city. You took it away from us, so we're going to destroy it. Which we've seen in other areas of this war between Russia and Ukraine, that this is how they operate. If we can't have it, we're going to turn it into dust.
Yeah, and this week's missiles specifically, not just Kherson or Kherson, depending on which network you listen to. But of course, there's 70% of Kyiv, capital city Kyiv, has no power either, and those missile strikes are drawing. Moral outrage. Sorry to say it, but there you go. And, of course, Russia also passed an anti-LGBTQ law this week as well. So they're just winning on all fronts, it looks like. I don't know. Mexico wants American extradited on charges in death of U.S. tourists. I just saw this story for the first time about a half an hour ago when I was doing a news report for your show. Mexican prosecutors have filed charges against a U.S. woman suspected of killing another American. And it's in a viral video where you can see the beating, and Mexico would like to have that suspect back.
Well, there shouldn't be a problem here. There should certainly be no prejudice about the American authorities saying, oh, you know, an American killed a Mexican person and maybe there's political ramifications here or whatever. It's another American. I mean, it shouldn't make a difference anyway, obviously, but it's an American who killed an American. It happened in Mexico. And I like the fact Mexico is saying is not doing the thing in reverse. Like, it was an American tourist that got killed. What do we care?
Right.
Oh, the person who killed them is back in the United States. Oh, well, I guess we're done with this case. No, they want to prosecute it.
Huh. Is this a common practice? Are you seeing anything typical here or anything atypical here?
Well, sometimes, you know, if you have a person from another country who meets harm in a country at the hands of somebody from that country, they don't necessarily take it as seriously.
Hmm. Yeah, this is, I'll follow this one a little bit. It's some, also there's the social media ripple effect happening here too, as well. Cause apparently in the video, which I've not seen, but in this story we're reading from the Associated Press, in the video, a man with an American accent can be heard saying, "Can you at least fight back?" And the man did not appear to intervene in the beating. So,
yeah. And they also said, cause you know, it was a group of Americans down there. And this woman, this poor woman, is found dead. And then the other people were like, they had different stories about what had happened, or they claimed they had no idea what happened. Ooh. When they knew damn well what happened.
Yeah.
You reported on this, 18 people rescued from a broken motorboat off the coast of San Diego, by some of them rescued by the Coast Guard and some of them rescued by Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and they were out there. Oh, man, there were kids. There were at least two young kids on there.
Yeah.
And they were out there for like 5 days.
5 days, no potable water, reportedly. Yeah.
Luckily, somebody else on another vessel spotted them finally.
Yeah. And 18 people in total. So awesome joint effort there. Mexico and United States authorities once again. Teaming up.
Working together.
Right, for some good news for a nice rescue. A Monrovia man arrested for attempted murder after driving through the front doors of a 7-Eleven store. Now, I woke up to this story this morning. Apparently, the guy went into the store, was upset, started throwing things around, left, got in his car, drove it through the front door of the 7-Eleven.
Then tried to run away, but they were able to detain him until the cops come. Well,
yeah, not
that
just
seems about right. Attempted murder, sure.
When we talked earlier in your show, we talked about somebody taking it upon themselves to chase somebody. So an employee chasing somebody out of a store that was going to rob and whatnot had bad.
Oh, no, this was the guy. Yeah, the guy who his landlord was at his restaurant.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And people tried to rob the restaurant. And then the woman, the landlord, like scared him away or got him to go away. And then they robbed her and they tried to drag her to the car and he went after them. But you're thinking about the very next story here, another person intervening at a Buffalo Wild Wings. Three teenagers tried to do a dine and dash from the Buffalo Wild Wings. And an employee decided he wasn't going to let him get away with that. And so he runs out there and jumps on the hood of their car and they're driving away and he's on the hood of the car and that car got up to speeds of 60 miles an hour before getting stuck in the snow. And it was a 16-year-old and her two friends who are 17.
Right.
And part of this was caught on police cam when they showed up. The dash cam caught, you know, the employee on the car and these kids in the car. And thank God nobody was seriously hurt. But that's another thing where I don't think you risk your life over the bill at a Buffalo Wild Wings.
No, I mean, they are good wings, but at the same time. Yeah, so that's three. We have three of these stories with, I think people just fed up. Maybe it's just, enough of this dine and dash stuff. Enough of you driving your car through the front of my 7-Eleven.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just the owner, by the way, of the 7-Eleven. Customers also held the guy.
It was everybody who was there, man. Yeah. They didn't like having suddenly a car in the middle of the store in the snack aisle.
It's National Leftovers Day today, and food coma is a phrase heard around the country. And tryptophan is an essential amino acid. Now, I did not have turkey yesterday. Apparently, you had a little bit to eat yesterday by your own admission about a half an hour ago when you were describing it. But apparently, food coma is not necessarily the turkey.
That's a myth. That's a myth that you eat turkey and it has tryptophan and it puts you to sleep. That is apparently not true in any way, shape, or form. I mean, there's a reason that it's become a myth because tryptophan is a precursor amino acid that makes serotonin.
Okay. So
serotonin is a feel-good brain chemical. It helps with sleeping. And also, when tryptophan is converted into serotonin, then you also get as a byproduct melatonin, which people take
mm-hmm.
to go to sleep. So because of all of that, people said, oh, there's tryptophan in turkey, and tryptophan, you kind of jump, you connect the dots real fast.
Right. Yeah, a little too
and
fast.
And you go, oh, well, then that's why you fall asleep. But that's you'd have to eat 7 pounds of turkey, or maybe it's 8 pounds of turkey to get an amount of tryptophan that would make you sleepy. So I guess there's some other thoughts now about why you get sleepy after the meal.
Well, before you get on the trypto train, before all those dominoes start to fall, it says it's a high amount of carbs that you're taking in as well. And of course, your blood flow goes from your head to your gut, and that helps slow things down too and makes you a little bit sleepy. So it's not necessarily the tryptophan. Good to know.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I like the other reason that they give, which is that you fall asleep after the meal is because it's so stressful leading up to the meal.
Oh.
The making of the meal and everything is so stressful that finally when you sit down and you eat the meal, mm-hmm. All that stress goes away.
Well, if that's the case,
why don't you on your keister too?
So after this England USA match at the World Cup later this morning, am I going to go to bed after that?
If you're super stressed about what's going to happen. Although here's the difference, I think, though, because that match, it depends on how it ends.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
you see, your stress may not be relieved. But after the Thanksgiving meal, the stress of making the Thanksgiving meal is over. And it's not like there's a winner and a loser. Right. So I think what I'm saying is you probably won't fall asleep.
Okay. Well, getting up at 2 a.m. might help me nap, but I get your point.
I get your point. As long as we're busting myths. this myth, not this is a myth that really should not need to be busted anymore, but people still do inquire as to whether putting raw onions in your room or even raw onions on your skin can cure a cold or the flu.
Never.
And the answer is no, they cannot. But this goes back to like the 15th century. And there was some myth got out that if you put onions in your room, you would not get the Black Plague.
Okay.
The bubonic plague, which was untrue, by the way. And it's persisted to this day. And also part of the problem is you will read from time to time about how onions have certain antimicrobial properties.
Mm-hmm.
But that means when you eat them and they go, and they're metabolized in your body, not when you rub them on your feet. Or when you cut an onion and stick it in the corner of your room before you go to bed.
Just real quick. What other science from the 15th century has been able to stick around as long as this? I've never heard of this, by the way. I've never done this.
I would say, you know what? Of all the things, leeches and all that stuff.
Yeah.
This one, I guess has not been debunked enough yet.
Huh.
Because there are people, I guarantee you, there are people who would, if you said, oh, why don't you try a leech? They would go, are you crazy?
Right.
And I'm not going to try a leech. I'm going to rub an onion on me.
I don't know how much of this is disinformation I've seen on some of my social feeds.
I'm a person of science. Leeches are bogus. It's onions all the way.
you're pro-onion. I get it. All right, fine. The National Onion Association might be looking to get your backing on that one, too. The rule that you need 8 glasses of water, we're busting another myth here. The rule you need 8 glasses of water a day is nonsense. That's according to a new study. I don't know. It seems a little strong. The 8x8 rule?
You say it's nonsense, but what they're saying is that the amount of water that people drink every day varies wildly all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And when you measure, they call it the daily turnover of water.
Right.
It's a fancy way of saying how much water you drank. They looked at 5,600 people from 26 countries from all ages, from little babies all the way to really old people. And there's no amount. It's all over the map. The
sure
average
is.
Ranged from 4 cups a day of water to 25 cups a day of water. But there are certain rules that are still true. The more you sweat, the more water you're going to want to drink. Bigger you are, the more water that you're going to want to drink. The more active you are, the more water that you're going to want to drink. But 8 glasses of water is not in any way better than 6 or 10 or 14 or 5. I think there's probably an optimum amount of water for each person on any particular day. But it's not just one amount of water that's the right amount of water every day.
Okay. I'm on a related note real quick. I'm looking at a headline. Bruce Lee died from drinking too much water. New study claims.
That's what they're saying. I know. Well, you can. I mean, you can die from drinking too much water. You don't hear about it too often because the amount of water you'd have to drink is so massive.
Right.
Almost nobody could do it. And also, they may not be right. It's sort of a theory that they are proposing. Those guys.
Huh.
Okay, finally.
All right.
I'm sorry, because the headline is really great. A man has won in court the right to be boring at work. Now, wait, that's not exactly what it is. This guy worked, this is in France, and he worked for some company, and they had a real culture of going out for drinks after work. And the management was like, yeah, we all go out for drinks after work. And he didn't want to go.
Right.
And they fired him. They fired him because he wouldn't go out for drinks after work. So he went to court and he sued them. And the court said, that's right. You can't make somebody go out to drink.
Yeah.
You can't fire them because they don't want to go out and have drinks after work.
I can see his point on this. You know what I mean? You booked your hours for the week. Maybe you don't want to hang out with those people again. I don't know. I mean, like, okay, look, I've been in newsrooms the vast majority of my career has been in newsrooms, save for 1 year when I was in PR. And going out for drinks was just kind of like, that's the way stuff goes down, right? So I told my boss one time on a Friday, I was like, look, I don't mind hanging out with you for a happy hour or whatnot, but I'm not going to do it on my dime. You're going to do it on your dime if you want me to go with you drinking. And so we would leave at 3 o'clock in the afternoon rather than 5 o'clock.
Well, I think in this company, they considered that to be on the clock. That's why they fired.
Oh, you're right. Well, it is France. So
they in their mind, it was like, this is part of the job is to go. But also apparently if you read further, they would also do things like they'd go out and drink and then go get in bed together and stuff.
That's weird.
It's like a really crazy place to work.
They also accused him of being a poor listener and being difficult to work with. So yeah,
that's another problem.
Was he a coworker or a spouse?
All right, that is Handle on the News, late edition. When we come back, we're going to have for you some cool space news with Rod Pyle, including the resolution of a big naming controversy at NASA. It's KFI AM 640 live everywhere on the iHeart Radio app.